When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who's going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Welcome to another podcast at SlicedOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers, Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Teamsters Local 695. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times. Brother, good to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure, man.
And happy Labor Day weekend.
Happy Labor Day weekend, which we should be celebrating and talking up on every level.
We will, and you'll be joining me at Labor Fest on Monday. Looking forward to that.
I am too.
All right, another round of interesting elections in the state of Florida. The mayor of Tallahassee had a surprise upset. Andrew Gillum beat a number of other people who had outspent him $90 million to $6 million. And, of course, $6 million in Florida, normally you'll get you a win in the Tallahassee mayor's race, but but not normally statewide.
Perspective. No, but to give people perspective, if a Wisconsin, you know, a lot of our listeners are in Wisconsin, if a Wisconsin Democratic primary candidate had had $6 million, that would have been the dominant candidate by
far, right?
You know, and it might well have influenced or tipped the race. In Florida, for a couple of reasons that actually ultimately we circle around and explain why Gillum won this race, this incredible victory. In Florida, over the last really 50 years, they've developed a high-end media politics that sort of led the nation. Now other states have gotten a lot more like it, but they kind of led the nation in this idea of the wall-to-wall TV campaign. And because Florida has so many media markets, when you look at that map, there's, you know, like 8 different places where you have to be up with a lot of TV. You know, big budget campaigns are the way of it.
Can you imagine driving from Pensacola to Miami? How long would that take?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And those are all media markets, right? And very different places. And so this idea of sort of like flooding the state with TV ads and then now in radio and some social media is a big thing. Here's what Gillum did. $6 million was enough to build a great grassroots campaign. It was not enough to build a media campaign. So Gillum went for a grassroots campaign that combined a lot of outreach to people who aren't always invited to come vote. They're welcome to come vote, but they're not always invited. And also to, you know, Democratic voters have become very disenchanted with the party. And finally, specifically, to young people, right, new voters. And what he did was a lot of communication, a lot of organizing on the ground, an incredibly high-energy campaign, moving around the state to every corner of it, and collecting endorsements from activist groups in the state and around the country who then communicated to their lists of allies. These are groups that are clearly progressive. Our Revolution, the progressive, different progressive groups like Democracy for America and Color of Change PAC and all these groups. That helped him a lot. Finally, he physically put himself in alliance with groups that are working on the ground. So when the Parkland shooting, you know, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas high school shootings occurred earlier this year, Gillum did something that was actually a rather delicate intervention. He didn't throw himself at the front of things. He didn't try to grab all the limelight, but because that was going to go to the students who've used it so well. But he put himself present there. He was at their side. He marched with them. He spoke at their rallies. He was much more present than other political figures. And that got him a lot of goodwill, got him a lot of engagement. And so all of this played together. And then there was a final element. He worked hard to get the endorsement of Bernie Sanders. He wanted Bernie Sanders' support. And he got it at the start of August at a point when some polls had him in fourth place, if you can imagine it. I mean, or at least third to fourth place in a very weak position. But Bernie Sanders took a chance, endorsed Gillum, and then agreed to come to the state and really barnstorm through some key towns in the state with Gillum. And all of this kind of came together in the final weeks of the campaign. And you saw the result. By about 2 to 3%, he defeated the clear front runner, who was Beth Graham.
Beth Graham, mm-hmm. Yeah. Who was a very credible candidate.
Oh, you know, this is the important thing to understand. We've had a number of these races around the country this year, where in Maryland, in Georgia, in Illinois, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Iowa, in Minnesota, where you've had crowded fields, often crowded fields of candidates, all of whom you could make a case for, right? All of whom you could say, well, that candidate could be a great statewide contender. What has happened in a number of states, and it's really interesting, is that Democratic primary voters have made a bet that national Democrats still wrestle with. And that bet is on a high turnout November strategy, right? Nominating someone who tends to be younger, more energetic, not necessarily physically energetic, but just in the style of their campaign, and is reaching out to a progressive, multiracial, multiethnic, new American majority, as one group refers to it. And that's where you see Ben Jealous coming from in Maryland. That's where you see Stacey Abrams coming from in Georgia. That's where you see Andrew Gillum coming from in Florida.
Yeah. And also, of course, the difference is Ben Jealous doesn't have much of a chance of winning in Maryland, where Andrew Gillum does have a chance of winning in Florida.
Well, you know, I will counsel you, be careful, even on Jealous. If this strategy is right, okay, if this strategy is true, it's a very hard strategy to pull. Right? Because you are literally talking about bringing new people into the mix. And so in all of these races, it's an interesting approach. I even think you see a bit of a hybrid in Wisconsin. You know, Tony Evers is clearly a candidate who's kind of mainstream.
But let's be honest. Let's differentiate here. Michigan and Wisconsin went with safer choices. And I would argue that Michigan and Wisconsin are two very similar states. Surprising because they both have deeper roots with progressive politics than Florida does. I've never thought of Florida as a particularly progressive Democratic state when it comes to voters. So this
Why? Have you forgot about Claude Pepper?
Yes, no, and Donna Shalala is going to have Claude Pepper's seat. How about that?
Potentially. Yeah. And you know what? Can I tell you something? This is the thing. Florida, you're right that Wisconsin, Minnesota, to some extent Michigan, and these states of the upper Great Lakes region have historically had a progressive tradition and progressive politics, right? But one thing about Florida to understand is Florida is a steadily growing and steadily changing state politically. And so you can't really apply the historic models to it in the same way that you can in other places. There's data that shows that some stunning number of people in Florida, are essentially fresh voters, right? New voters, whether they're usual participants or people drawn into the process, who, you know, literally are being introduced to the issues of the state and the political culture of the state right now. As a result, Florida tends to have a very nationalized politics. You know, they have a lot of politics that kind of moves according to the national trends.
Well, people have moved there from all over the country.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so Gillum actually recognized a lot of that and continues to recognize it. But in fairness, although we can talk about his opponent and should for a moment, his opponent also recognizes that. Ron DeSantis, the Republican congressman who was nominated over a much better funded sort of establishment choice in the Republican primary, also surfed national trends and national patterns to get himself nominated. And he did that by completely wrapping himself around Donald Trump. There is no candidate running in 2018 in so high-profile a race who is so fully wedded to Donald Trump as Ron DeSantis.
Yes, he was on Fox 26 times during the primary, which they say was actually worth about $9 million in advertising. Here's how the race, quote unquote, started.
You know, he is an articulate spokesman for those far left views, and he's a charismatic candidate. And, you know, I watched those Democrat debates. None of that was my cup of tea. But I mean, he performed better than the other people there. So we've got to work hard to make sure that we continue Florida going.
All right. If he had just stopped right there, he would have been fine. But he
and a relatively mainstream candidate, my cup of tea.
But what he didn't do was stop right there.
Going in a good direction. Let's build off the success we've had on Governor Scott. The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda with huge tax increases and bankrupting the state. That is not going to work. That's not going to be good for Florida. So I'm going to fight for what I believe in, because I think I'm the guy who can really lead Florida in a good direction.
Well, you know, I got to see the look on Donna Edwards' face and Michael Steele's face when Chuck Todd played that clip. And I wouldn't say that Donna Edwards and Michael Steele are two peas in a pod, but they both came to the same conclusion. I think they were as offended by that articulate stuff as they were about the monkey.
Well, yeah, because it's this thing of, do you really need to point out that, you know, a brilliant young political figure who, you know, has led national groups, organized national groups. A guy, by the way, I started writing about Andrew Gillum. This is astounding, because the guy's, you know, very young. I started writing about him in 2002. He was active on the ground, you know, back, you know, 16 years ago. He's been an important part of the politics of Northwest Florida, but also something else. He has made such an impression nationally over quite a bit of time that when the Russians hacked Podesta's emails, one of the things they got was his long list of potential vice presidential candidates that he had, you know, circulated within the Clinton campaign back in 2016. Andrew Gillum's name was on it, right? So to, you know, then be sort of like surprised or feeling it's necessary to note that, yeah, he's a good talker, right? I mean, that it's a weird and unsettling way of communicating.
Although you have to admit, if you were to compare him to Ron Johnson,
right? Well, admittedly, you know. But the interesting thing is that then to go to that and in what was obviously a very well-thought answer. That was not a casually delivered, stumbling, oh, I'm trying to think of something to say soliloquy. To go to, is it monkey this up?
Yeah.
Right? Or monkey it up?
I've never heard that phrase before.
Never heard that phrase myself either. I'm unfamiliar with it. But I do believe the chair of the Florida Democratic Party's immediate response was a pretty accurate one. And this wasn't one that the chair of the Democratic Party in Florida had to think about for a day to figure out how to respond. Her immediate response was racist dog whistle.
Seems like it's a little bit more than the whistle. Here is
racist dog shout.
Whoever the talking head on Fox was shortly after that interview came on and said this.
A little while ago, we had Ron DeSantis, the Republican nominee for governor in Florida, on for an interview to discuss the Florida election. During the interview, he made what some are calling an inappropriate comment about his Democratic opponent, Andrew Gillum. We do not condone this language and wanted to make our viewers aware that he has since clarified his statement.
I don't think he ever clarified his statement, really.
He never clarified. That's a bogus. Clarification on the part of Fox that makes things less clear. But the fact
that she came on and had to say anything is, you know,
well,
for
you
Fox.
You know what happened, right? You know how that happens. They're all like, you know, oh, that's a point where the interviewer should have paused
right.
the interview and said, Mr. DeSantis, what do you mean by that?
You could see the, by the look on her face that he had just stumbled, because she was like, oh boy.
Yeah, but that's
she should part. Yes, of course she should.
Yeah.
Have.
And so they know that the second they finish that, there's people in the control room going, whoa, you know, we're gonna carry some of the blame for this.
It's interesting
so they
though
push the blame off.
Andrew Gillum did not get indignant or overly wrought about this. I thought he played this well.
His response was to mock that articulate talk, right? He came on and says, well, I'm going to say something that's articulate and well thought or whatever, you know, and that's good. That's good because he's showing grace under pressure. He's showing a sense of humor. That's what you want in a governor, right? In fact, by any measure in this dust up between the two, this clash, Gillum showed the gubernatorial style. But there's also something else about Gillum that I think is very, very important on this one. He needs to be understood nationally as something more than the, you know, kind of like quick talking points that people are applying to him. This is a guy who since 2000, 2002, as a very young man, early 20s, right, has been thinking very, very seriously about how to move Florida in a progressive direction. He's been active for decades.
Right.
And it's a guy, you know, very young man. He's been active for decades in this. And a big part of his vision was summed up when he accepted his victory. And he accepted his victory in language that was very similar to some of the language that Bernie Sanders has used in his campaign. He thanked his supporters who were in the room for their incredible support for him and loyalty to a campaign that really was an uphill run. Then he said, I also want to thank the people who are outside this room. I want to thank the people, or I want to talk to at least, or communicate with them, the people who didn't vote, because I'm going to be spending the next few months trying to get you to vote. I want to also speak to the Republicans who haven't ever thought about voting for me, but I want to talk to you too, right? I want to talk to people who voted for Trump and say, you know, this isn't working for you. There's real things. So this is a guy who is absolutely determined to keep a conversation going with groups of voters that a lot of Democrats have not put a tremendous effort into reaching.
All right, we've got to take a break.
Happening.
We've got to take a break right there. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
You have a broken guitar? Don't fret. Take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson to Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We'll have you fretting your guitar in no time at all. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, we love guitars.
Welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works, as well as Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. All right, John Nichols, Associate Editor with the Capital Times with us. There is another primary coming, and it's in the state of New York in September. And the first debate between actress Cynthia Nixon and incumbent Governor Andrew Cuomo took place the other day. Here's how it went.
ATM, and we see the result. He has had 7.5 years to avoid this very avoidable crisis in our New York City subway, and he has done next to nothing.
Governor,
why would the
like
next 4 years
motion,
be any
motion.
Different?
Governor, would you like to respond to that?
My opponent lives in the world of fiction. I live in the world of fact. The subway system is owned by New York City.
The subway MTA system has been controlled by the state since 1965.
Can you stop interrupting? Can you stop interrupting?
Can you stop lying?
Yeah. As soon as you do.
Oh, that. Would you stop lying as soon as you do? So did the governor just admit that he was lying?
I think he totally did. Yeah. And you know what?
He sounded really grumpy there.
Sounded grumpy and desperate, right? He didn't want to do this debate. He felt he had
to. He's 30 points ahead.
Yeah, he is. But you know what? Gwen Graham was a lot of points ahead of Andrew Gillum in Florida.
Well, yes.
You know what I'm saying?
And Cuomo was aware of this.
And
Crowley had a pretty good lead in New York and the Bronx and Brooklyn, too.
Yeah, or in Queens, yeah. Queens. And so this is a very, it's a volatile time. And you know what? Andrew Cuomo is, you know, kind of dealing with one of the sins of the past in his gubernatorial race out there. The New York Democratic machine, his political elites, always try to be too smart by half. And so they have two primaries in New York. One primary for federal offices in June, and that's where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beat Crowley. Then they have another primary in September for state offices. So you've divided the whole thing up in a weird way already. And then they hold the September primary not on Tuesday, but on Thursday. Okay? So if you're not already a little confused, then throw on the fact that New York has incredibly complicated and very difficult laws as regards registering and voting. And they don't make voting easy there. They're as bad as many of the other states we complain about across the country. And so, as a result, this is going to be a low turnout primary. Or probably, I should say, probably a low turnout primary. In such a primary, when you've got an opponent who has a very motivated base, and Cynthia Nixon has a very motivated base. There's also a very motivated base, I think, coming out potentially to vote for Zephyr.
You broke up there.
There's also a very motivated base to potentially come out and vote for Zephyr Teach, out a reformer who's running for attorney general there. The reality is that Cuomo's looking at that primary in 2 weeks or less than 2 weeks, and I think he feels he has to do stuff. The weird part was two things that are really significant about this. You know, Cynthia Nixon has never run for statewide office. She's never run for local office. She's not a politician. She's an actress. She has been very active in civic affairs and well-regarded as such. But she's not a politician. If you watch that debate, two things came across. Number one, she held her own against Andrew Cuomo at most turns in that debate. And two, Cuomo was forced to treat her very seriously. You know, admittedly, he was gruff, he was mean, he was, you know, like weirdly aggressive at times. But at the end of the day, Cuomo was kind of on the same level, for at least a night, as Cynthia Nixon. I can't imagine that that doesn't end up helping her in those poll numbers. And I will tell you also, Cynthia Nixon is, you know, she's had stumbles as a first-time candidate. There's no question of that. But she has defined the issues and the character of the race in very significant ways. One thing she did in that debate was a lengthy discussion of marijuana laws, and she is running in favor of legalization of marijuana. But she went deep on that discussion. It was very smart. She was putting all sorts of real information on the table, and you could see Cuomo scrambling as a city governor to keep up. And weirdly enough, I'll tell you, this is a little detail. Day after the debate, after all the headlines and everything like that, Cuomo announces he's going to be having town halls on changing marijuana laws, right? So what we realize is that this challenge to a sitting Democratic governor by a progressive Democrat is having a very significant impact, no matter how it turns out.
You know, I don't understand Andrew Cuomo. His father was an incredibly gifted communicator and a good man. Didn't always agree with him, but a good man, great communicator, exuded warmth and passion. The other son, Chris Cuomo, who has developed one hell of a show in primetime. I mean, he is good.
It's fascinating. It's very human and very real show.
He connects with people on a visceral level. Yeah. What happened to Andrew Cuomo? Because I don't think I've ever seen a worse politician as far as how he communicates with people. He's terrible.
Yeah. He comes off, and I don't think there's any other way to say it, as a person who seems to be profoundly bothered, even offended by the fact that someone is asking him to comment on things. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, what do you mean? I know what I'm doing. Get out of my way. Get off my lawn. And, you know, he's not appealing as a political figure. He would translate horribly, I think, as the presidential candidate he seems to want to be. And it was fascinating. Did you see that in the debate, it's worth watching if people haven't seen it. A huge portion of the debate was devoted to trying to pin Cuomo down on whether he plans to serve a full term. And I could think of nothing so much as watching Scott Walker during the 2014 campaign when Walker was finding every way to talk around it and finally said, oh, yeah, I'm going to serve my, you know, I intend to serve my term. You know, Cuomo's in the same situation because everybody knows Cuomo would like to run for president or at least vice president. And so they're struggling to pin him down on it. And to his credit, you know, he kind of said strongly that he wouldn't, but they still didn't believe him. Literally, the anchors, the people doing the show, didn't believe him. So they kind of come back. Like, can we just pin this down one more time? You aren't going to. And he says, well, there's one exception, right? And the crowd just rocked at that point. You know, they thought he was going to, you know, try and game it because they're so used to him doing it. To his credit, he got a good laugh. He said, you know, unless the only thing that would, you know, prevent me from serving this term out, and everybody's like, oh, my gosh, he's actually going to try and gain this, is if God would strike me dead.
Oh.
That's good. You know, I mean, he at least got a laugh out of it. And you know, with Andrew Cuomo? Not a lot of laughs.
We should not overlook what happened in Oklahoma. They have runoffs there. Mitt Cornett, the very innovative, creative, moderate Republican mayor of Oklahoma City, who was thought to be a lock for that, also someone who didn't support Donald Trump, found out what happens when you don't support Donald Trump.
Yep. Here's the bottom line. Do you know what the dictionary definition for moderate Republican is?
I think it's right next to some dinosaur creature that's now extinct.
Yeah, well, it's dinosaur for sure, but the actual definition is someone who lost a Republican primary. because the fact of the matter is that there's one constant in 2018, and it's was less so even in 16 and 14 is that if you are in any way painted as somebody who might want to make government function, you know, if you want to have, you know, any kind of baseline functionality of government on behalf of the common good, you're out of there. You're toast. And that's why DeSantis won in Florida. That's why this very right-wing candidate won in
Stitt.
In Oklahoma. Yep. That's why Chris Kobach, who's a disaster, won in Kansas. I mean, the Republican gubernatorial crew is, you know, I mean, this is, you know, literally a slate of candidates, you know, that we have never seen the equivalent of this.
And so Drew Edmondson, the former Oklahoma Attorney General, someone who has blown the whistle on Scott Pruitt more than once, is... well-positioned to be competitive in Oklahoma. He's still the underdog, obviously. A tough state.
Yeah, but they elect Democrats now and again.
Well, Brad Henry was a very successful two-term governor in Oklahoma before Mary Fallon came in. Mary Fallon's approval rating in some polls is in the single digits.
Yeah, I know. It just didn't work, did it? look, here's the bottom line. When you start in Oklahoma, Texas, I think, is a unique entity and has to be viewed differently. although Beto O'Rourke's doing some interesting stuff there. But you start in Oklahoma and you work your way across the Mid-South. You know, what you find is, and even into the deeper South, you find is those states can vote for a Democrat for governor if the Democrat actually has a solid vision for running the state and the Republican seems to be way out there. You saw that happen in Louisiana. You have seen that happen in not that distant past in Kentucky and in Tennessee, up till not that long ago, Arkansas.
Right.
And so, you know, what I'm saying is this is something that the national Democrats have to recognize. Yes, there is a different political culture in the Mid-South and into that, you know, that sort of slightly western area as you go out toward.
Well, that's the thing. Oklahoma is a western, midwestern, yeah, and southern state.
All at once. I agree. And the same, you know, Kansas has some of that complex mix as well. Even mm-hmm. some parts of Colorado mix it up. But, you know, the thing to understand about this is the National Democratic Party has to recognize this and take advantage of it in the best of ways. And there's a historical precedent for it. If you look back at 2002, 2004, 2006, when the Democrats were really rising and doing, you know, some areas of the country doing way better than expected, having breakthroughs. One of their big breakthrough areas was the interior West. And there were a number of those Western states that saw the rise of a distinct Western-style Democrat. And they were actually hunting and fishing the whole bit there, but also really good managers and had an element of economic populism as well. And that worked. And so when we talk about the whole of the map, right, and we've been talking a lot today about gubernatorial races, you know, people are going to win different ways in different places. But the one thing that I do think is constant and has to be there is an economic populism. You have to have at least some element of that. And it may be different in different states, who you're aiming it at and what you're doing. But, you know, we're talking on Labor Day weekend. And one element of it that I would strongly emphasize is you have to be explicitly supportive of labor unions. You can't simply be, oh yeah, I think, hope working people get a fair break. That day is past. The Republican Party declared war on labor. It went out after organized labor, state after state, and now at the national level. And you have to have some counter message to that, and because it's one of the ways that you create clarity in these races.
Before we go, this young man who was a survivor from the Parkland shooting, David Hogg, is working on a project yeah. with the New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, but getting young people to vote. Mm-hmm. And David Hogg has said some things that I don't agree with. I don't entirely agree with his agenda on some things, on other things yeah. I do with guns, right? But he's been a little strident. He's clearly, the kid's got a healthy ego. He's off the charts smart. So yeah. he was on Morning Joe the other day, and Mika was ready to end the interview without letting him kind of get a final parting shot in. And he pushed his way in, and he said this, and I just love this. Listen to what he said.
When it comes to voting for people, young people, we are starting to see this shift in America, that not only around voting for young people, but around the fact that when wealthier people are running, younger people are starting to think, why would these people be wanting to fix a world that, quite frankly, a lot of us think that they messed up?
Mm-hmm.
Like the president being a billionaire. Why would somebody, these people that are creating a lot of the problems that we face as a nation right now, are coming back into politics and saying that they want to solve them, when in reality, they're only in it for themselves, and that's the truth. But that's why it's so important that we vote, because no matter what your opinion is, you get out there and you vote on November 6th. You get out there and you register on September 25th in a bipartisan effort, because you can say what you want about politics, but if you don't vote, you have no right to.
Amen. And David's
all right.
Fair.
That is not something a political pundit would say, but it is so apt.
Yeah, it's totally apt. And it's also, it's an important part of this, right? In fact, I wish they'd let him take it one more step and say, you know, that when wealthy people run and they say they want to fix the problems, and he's saying, well, these are problems they created. Also, these are people that benefited off these problems. Why would they change a system and a structure from which they have benefited massively? Right? If you are, you know, a guy who basically spends his time flying around and appearing on reality TV shows and divorcing people and marrying other people and, you know, but not really doing all that much of consequence, and yet you could be a billionaire, you know, maybe the system is just a little bit skewed in your favor. And why realistically would you change that? And so,
well,
yeah, I'm generally, my rule is I'm not going to be voting for billionaires this year.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Happy Labor Day and solidarity.
Solidarity, brother.
Sly'sOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.